You're listening to the Illuminaire podcast, where we dive deep into behavioral health topics and shine a bright light on the forces shaping this industry's future, from research and technology to business and investment and more. Here's your host, Dr. Ronit Molko.
Hi, everybody. This is Dr. Ronit Molko, and welcome to this week's episode of the Illuminaire podcast. Today, I'm thrilled to welcome my good friend and colleague, Dr. Evian Gordon. Evian is the founder, executive chairman, and CMO of Total Brain. He established an integrative neuroscience approach grounded in the use of standardized methods across multiple types of brain data in a single platform with over a million data sets. Evian founded the first and largest standardized international database on the human brain. The database is the asset which has shaped TotalBrain.com for brain fitness, mental health, and peak performance, used in over 40 major companies in over 800,000 employees, including Boeing, AARP, and Cerner. Evian has published over 250 scientific papers and three books, The Brain Revolution, Integrative Neuroscience, and Integrative Neuroscience and Personalized Medicine. Evian, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Anit.
I would appreciate it if you would start off and explaining the 1-2-4 brain model.
So thank you. Yes, what we saw from the International Brain Database and from the brain science literature is that when you bring all the pieces together, and it's very helpful to have a framework. And now, of course, the brain's 85 billion neurons, very complicated system, but there is an essence. And the essence began with the fact that the brain's key organizing principle, the one in the 1-2-4, is safety. The brain is about safety first and foremost because we have evolved to keep out of danger. And so the one and the primary organizing principle is safety first. Once you have safety organized, you're more likely to be able to achieve rewards. Now, underpinning safety and the entire organizational structure of the brain are two modes of function. Non-conscious, some people call it unconscious, but non-conscious is we're kind of aware of it. It's our intuition. It's the biases we have, the cues that we read in body language, in voice, or in threats from the environment, sounds, loud sounds. That world, that entire communication of these cues are essentially the way we process emotions. They are our snap judgments to basically keep us in that safety first. So the safety first brain had to find, it would appear, some rapid way to read these cues in the environment or from other people socially. And that is an entirely non-conscious, there are no words, it's basically cues and symbols, voice tonality. And then consciously, which is the second mode, the two in the second mode, is our rational thinking, the details, the words, the rationalizations. So that's the second piece. And the fascinating increasing neuroscience insight, Ronit, is that the non-conscious brain is working these rapid snapshots, these rules of thumb, the shortcuts for the brain to know what is safe and what is not safe, or what is safe and what is rewarding, more to the point. It's happening in a fifth of 1 second. So this is the timeline on which we exist, these fractions of a second that are driving our other elements of our brain, like the details, like the thinking, like the decision-making. And so the four is really more like the broader functions of this process, the safety and this non-conscious conscious mode. And the four are things that are involved, the four processes, key processes are emotions, the non-conscious cues, the feelings at about half a second of having this emotional, say you feel like fear, you feel your heart rate go up, your sweat rate increases, your breathing changes, and those are your feelings. So it's feelings and emotions should not be used interchangeably. They have a very interesting, deep physiological cadence. The emotions come first in your brain, fraction of a second, and then at about half a second, we become consciously aware of their consequences. So we kind of experientially, subjectively can feel it. That's the feeling. So that's the emotions and the feelings. That's two out of the four. And then, of course, cognition. Everybody knows that cognition is primarily about memory, focus, and planning, how to get your goals, and the whole rationalizing process of slower, more detailed exploration of how we really want to evaluate those intuitions. Are they aligned with our thinking, with our cognition? And then self-control, which is the fourth part of the four, is really how we put it all together. How do we kind of look at our brains, these 85 billion neurons, how do we make sense of it all and adapt in the moment? So that's the essence of having a framework, a model, that can, it's like putting on a new lens when you actually think about not just the 1, 2, 4, but the fact that the 1 and the 2, the beginning of the 2, the non-conscious, is happening incredibly quickly, fifth of a second. Whereas the others, the conscious and then the emotion, the feelings, the cognition and the self-control, are happening over much longer time scales. So that's, the brain is not just about a kind of theoretical concept, but it gives us a window into the dynamics in real time to be able to get a better sense of ourselves and of others, of our decisions and the consequences of them.
So is the fight or flight response, is that triggered at the non-conscious level?
Absolutely. So that is why, whether it's COVID or whether it's any situation that is threatening, COVID physically threatening, and of course the threat of uncertainty. But if somebody smiles at you and it's inauthentic, if it's authentic, they'll smile, you'll see the crinkles in the corner of their eyes. That's the cue non-consciously that you pick up that it's authentic. Whereas if they smile just with their mouth, you know it's inauthentic. So that immediately triggers the emotions, your intuitions of it, and that triggers the whole process, the process of then moving to how you feel it, what you make of it, how you think about it, the decisions you make around it. So that's really useful to think of the brain as a timing system rather than just a system, you know, with labels. It's literally a dynamical, adaptive system, and the more we can attune to that internally and externally in terms of dynamics, the more empowering that theoretical model, but it's a very practical and applied model, can be deployed.
So when we talk about anxiety and stress hijacking the brain, what actually happens when the brain gets hijacked?
So let's take that consequence of, say, a threat, any threat, physical or it could be emotional as interpersonal situation. So now that threat, you pick up the cue in a fifth of a second, you now activate, so that's happening non-consciously in the deepest recesses of your brain, and then it also activates a structure which everybody's heard of, which is your alarm system of the brain, your amygdala, and that then activates a very critical fight, flight system in your brain and in throughout your body. And that is to get you out of danger. So coming back to the safety first organizing principle, you activate your fight, flight. Now it's to get you out of danger. So think about it in the moment. What does getting out of the danger mean? Firstly, you've got to narrow your focus of attention. So you just focus on the danger. So that you have a very inflexible, shut down, rapid process of keeping you in the moment to get out of danger. Now, in doing that, your heartbeat becomes very constant to get as much oxygen to your muscles as possible to get you out of danger. Then you also increase your sweat and you basically constrict your arteries in case you bleed, so you don't bleed out too much. Your digestion stops. So your entire process becomes narrow, shut down, consistent beating, and it allows you in the moment in rare situations to deal with a really serious threat. That's what it was designed for. And it wasn't designed to last for longer than, you know, half a minute or a couple of minutes. That is the fight flight system. Now, there are only two primary systems, just like we have one primary organizing principle, which is safety. We have two primary principles. The other side of the coin of the fight-flight system is the opposite. The calm, flexible, rest and digest converse to that, which is called the vagus, V-A-G-U-S system. So we really are living our lives and our brain and body's physiology in firstly fractions of a second. So in every few seconds or fractions of a second sometimes, we can change our brain state, and we imbalance all the time between stress, fight, flight, if you activate it, or calm and flexible. and we have 50,000 thoughts approximately a day. And so, again, another guiding principle in this framework, in addition to the 1-2-4, is the fact that that is used to resolve how many of those 50,000 thoughts we have that are negative or positive, how many of them are in a stress fight-flight mode or in a non-calm fight-flight mode, or how many of them in a flexible, cognitively flexible, open, slower, more decision-making capabilities, more adaptive frame of reference.
So when we look at our current environment, we've got COVID, we've got the election coming up and all the issues around, you know, the political divide, we've got the racial unrest and all the unrest and protests that have come about because of racial inequality. Are we living in a constant state of fight or flight?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's certainly predisposing us to that. I mean, again, the brain is about thresholds. So we have these 50,000 thoughts, we have these fractions of a second processes. And if we, you know, the brain is so highly interconnected that it's like throwing a pebble into the water. If you just nudge that system, it's so sensitive and highly interconnected and dynamical because it's a timing system. It's not a verbal, theoretical, la-la land system kind of based just on a series of words and labels. It is an analog, massively parallel processing system. So when you're nudging that brain with these micro and macro threats continually, and if there's not a kind of organized way in which to deal with and contextualize, reframe a strategy to deal with not just what is nudging us into the stress, magnification, and fight-flight state, it can become a kind of contagious, because the brain is very contagious, because it's called entrainment, that when you ping the brain with an input, it recruits other neurons to deal with it. So the brain is operating in very simple frequencies, because it's so complicated that it's had to reorganize itself at a macro level into certain fundamental frequencies. We all know them, like when you know that when you're asleep, the frequencies are very low, your firing rate is very low. When you're thinking, it's like above like 20, certainly above 12 cycles per second. But they're very organized. So the brain, despite this complexity, it's got a deep organizing structure. So we really are triggering those specific states all the time. And they, if we predispose them to threat, we're moving the needle of the whole environment. And it's so contagious. And it's so entraining other neurons that we're pushing towards living in this contagious, reinforcing dynamic of negativity, threat magnification, and if it gets too consuming, then the brain becomes overwhelmed and it starts going into a cycle of decline, starts shutting down, it starts being incredibly simplistic and overwhelmingly negative. So it's a very challenging dynamic because there's not a lot of respite in terms of the physical, the uncertainty, the kind of continual threats and pinging that are going on a scale that I certainly have never experienced before, never seen before globally, on a global scale anyway.
So if we look at this, you know, in terms of behavioral health, if we look at three categories, our seniors, I mean, we have, you know, our baby boomer population is aging and is going to be, I think, I don't remember the exact date, but some point we're going to have more people over the age of 65 than under the age of 14 in this country. So we have this booming aging population. And then, of course, as you know, I'm focused in the autism industry. And so understanding individuals with autism and how this impacts them. And then looking at technology, first of all, with seniors, I mean, I'm assuming that this high level of stress and anxiety further impacts memory, cognition, general executive functioning.
So really, one of the other deep principles that we're seeing in the brain, Ronit, is that stress and anxiety is the gateway to all of mental health, all of it. So the issue of then having this enhanced stress and anxiety coupled with the fact of the uncertainties of aging at a time where, you know, medical services and just the health of of people is clearly being challenged. And we know also that there's a massive revolution that's been discovered about inflammation, that we are getting a lot of the way we eat and the way that stress, because stress, the final pathway of stress is cortisol, and it causes enormous inflammation in our brains, in our bodies. It's so chronic illness is now being escalated by kind of inflammatory responses, and that includes depression, but it's, you know, very much so for cardiac disease and all the chronic illnesses, actually. And people are now looking into inflammatory impacts on Alzheimer's and mild cognitive impairment. But so certainly for aging people, and then the understandable fear about memory, where the cortisol is known to kill cells in the hippocampus, which is responsible for converting short-term into long-term memory. And also we have cortical loss, which is also compounding the loss of memory, is a major factor. I do have to say one thing about aging. You know, the AARP uses our Total Brain International Database assessment in their wonderful site called Staying Sharp. And so I've been very interested in following, and also I'm old enough for this to be my category. And so the thing that is interesting is that in the database, the international database, yes, we do lose memory, and we do lose these cortical, outer cortical memory networks, and we definitely, you know, have loss of neurons in our hippocampus. But strangely enough, with age, the aging brain, unless it's kind of affected by cardiac and other illnesses, does actually get better at emotion regulation. And in fact, the deeper structures like the amygdala that we talked about earlier, triggering the fight flight, get preserved. So there are ways when you have a brain framework that is starting to get a little more detailed than the simplistic sort of models of the past, that you can see ways where we can intervene to magnify what is preserved, like people as they age get better at pattern recognition of the bigger things that matter. So there are ways where we cannot be over, you know, there's a time to reframe as well, to actually think a little differently and a little more broadly and creatively and innovatively about how to use what is preserved and what people do get better at. It is all a dynamical process. There's a developmental process that lasts over a lifetime, and there are some deficits but benefits for each of those phases that we can maybe think about using more effectively, of which emotional and pattern recognition are two examples in the elderly that can be enhanced, as well as some very specific ways in which to reduce stress and enhance memory. You know, in memory, I give a lot of talks now on memory in elderly. You know, it's really simple. I mean, there's chunking principles, well-established principles of memory, to chunk into threes things that you want to remember, to associate. You know, the Romans knew it, the Roman room story, where people would remember something in their room that they could associate with what they wanted to remember when they were giving speeches. They would go around the room remembering an object and the associated idea. These are simple principles, but they really work if you can also constrain stress, if you can control stress. So there is this is a challenge for the elderly, but there, it is also, you know, the one thing we've seen about behavior change, as you know, Ronit, and as somebody who's been so deeply immersed in clinical psychology and in behavior change and helping so many people, the reality is that real deep challenges are very threatening and a hijack, but they're also an opportunity to reframe. People change the most when they're the most fearful. So it is, it's not all just a one-sided cycle of decline.
Yes, they say pain is the greatest motivator, right?
Pain is the greatest motivator, for sure.
So in terms of autism, I mean, what we're seeing now, you know, in general, individuals with autism suffer from anxiety and depression. I think that there's an 80% comorbidity there. Certainly adults have very high anxiety and depression. And what's happened with COVID is that the increased isolation, the change in routine, the lack of structure, the lack of predictability, you know, the increased uncertainty is having a very negative effect. What tools can they use or can be employed to help manage this?
Yeah. Well, you know, I was really struck in your wonderful podcast that you did on the Total Brain podcast series that you spoke on this, and you really educated so many people in our network about how in autism the routinization and, for example, the hand flapping is a form of stress control, and how it's all about authenticity. And I really, and I've had a lot of hugely positive and helpful feedback from your podcast on this, in that that authenticity and this ability to frame our understanding of the brain and the brain-body dynamical system, to put a fresh lens on that so that we can attune to what are the authentic ways in which people with autism can self-manage the sort of anxiety cues. And it's all coming down, Ronette, whether it's the elderly, whether it's people with autism, whether it's mental health conditions, of trying to get a handle on the triggering of the stress as early as possible, as quickly as possible. And I mean in the moment, so that when people feel the cue, the arousal level going up and the potential to shut down into a fight flight, to find strategies that work for that individual. You know, it's all about what works for you. But once we have a more sophisticated lens on the timing of this, then there maybe are ways to attune to that authentic need of people with autism or deal with stress in a slightly different way, to find ways to use breathing techniques, for example, distractions. I know that there are things, you know, people have put things on their wrist and snap them and things like that. It doesn't matter what works. I also, by the way, I'm a big believer in neurostimulation. There's sounds and music inputs and voice inputs, but body language, even body language cues, you know, just pulling our shoulders back versus stooping has such a different trigger to put us into more of a sort of stress state than a versus an open, vagus, flexible state. So the point is that self-management of diminishing the overwhelm feeling, which is what was so fascinating to when you articulated how frustrating it is for people to not have their authenticity with autism attuned to, you know, validated and sort of aligned to, was very powerful. So this is an opportunity to help people self-monitor by picking up the cues more quickly, attuning, you know, just getting a sense of comfort with the simplest of them all, which is breath. You know, it turns out that when you breathe at 6 breaths per minute, it's the best break that you can have on the flight system that we've discovered. It's a very strange quirk. Actually, I mean, it's a 2,500-year-old idea. Everybody knows about breathing slowly, but it turns out at 6 breaths per minute, you put a brake on your fight-flight system as you exhale. It's the exhale that puts the brake on. And so there are little strategies like that where if they used simply and effectively with a couple of breaths in the moment and with a slightly longer exhale, can put a brake on the fight-flight system. And then that's in the moment. And then, of course, there's in the long run, where we're finding the right strategies. I'm talking about autism as everything, whether it's aging, autism, or people with mental health conditions. In the long run, then looking at ways of thinking about the long run, whether it's reframing, you know, in terms of shifting the sort of thinking traps that can be reframed, or whether it's just many of the other ways in which you can eat the right things, exercise the right way, sleep more effectively, that support the way that you deal with the 50,000 thoughts in the moment. And the main thing I'd say, Ronette, is just a greater emphasis that we're starting, I think all of neuroscience is starting to focus on, which is instead of just this la-la land list of things and odd tips here and there, to really think strategically about this as a dynamical system, every one of us as a dynamical system. There's no them and us. We all face the same dynamics. It's all incredibly similar. In nuance, the details are tiny different. And how do we deal with, how do we circuit break? How do we intervene in a way that personally works for people in those seconds as the stress begins? Because if you lose that battle, then the interconnectedness of the contagion becomes so powerful that anybody can be overwhelmed. So the it's slightly more challenging, but I think the impact, the closer you get to the mechanism of the brain, the bigger the impact. And so I think once we see it as in the moment versus in the long run, and then we personalize it as much as possible. And also, Ronette, the other thing we're seeing is that you don't need to do 100 things. You can just do one thing that works. Like sometimes it can be, you know, as I say, a couple of breaths at 6 breaths per minute rate. It can be, a lot of people use aromatherapy. It can be literally a smell. It could be a sound. It could be a visual symbol. It could be a body language cue. There's so many examples that we're seeing, but the key seems to be about depth. That if you do one thing, and why is it about depth rather than breadth? Because The brain is about wiring. It's about connections. So if you do not rewire something, you're in the infotainment business. I mean, it's not, it's cool, it's fun, it's fine, but it's not a habit changer. We live or die as a consequence of our habits. And so if we want a new habit, we've got to rewire it. Neurons that fire, to neural networks that fire together, wire together. And habits, you know, take a minimum of about 30 training days, 10 minutes a day, and they've got to be super granular. So we can find one thing, like let's just say, the breath and the way that people are present when they do that in the moment breath and even how they breathe. But whatever it is, you rewire that breath in the moment with whatever associative thoughts work and do that in depth. So you rewire a neural network that is about breaking stress in the moment. And that, I believe, Ronette, whatever it is, breath, aromatherapy, body language, whatever, is the most powerful thing we can do to begin a kind of broader reframe of switching as many of those 50,000 thoughts into the most constructive thoughts that can be over our day.
That's really just fascinating. So I guess the breath or the aromatherapy or the, you know, changing your body posture, that's hacking stress in the moment, right? Mm-hmm. The long-term structural changes, is that where it's more about lifestyle, diet, eating,
lifestyle. Well, let's start exercise. Off even, so let's take with breath. So we start off with mindfulness, because mindfulness is great if you can do it. But then, yes, all the other. And by the way, the biggest one of those to start with, if the big revolutions are right and that they're right now in the moment, they're about two things. For physical health, it's about inflammation. You can reverse chronic illness, and that's not my view, that's a wonderful bit of research from about 30 years of research actually from Dean Ornish, and I urge your listeners to look at a book called Undo It. He's got the evidence for the first time. You know, my PhD was in serum lipids, as you know, Ronette, in the cardiac world before I switched to the brain. And there is a revolution. I presented at the American Heart Association in November, and I was shocked to see that there at the American Cardiology Conference, they were talking about looking super seriously at this holistic approach to dealing with inflammatory conditions and reversing. So Dean Ornish showed you can reverse inflammation. And what were the key things? The top two, diet and stress. So with diet, it's also important to make sure that we're not eating toxic foods and that we have some idea of this issue of omega-3 versus omega-6, you know, the good omega-3s and omega-6 that can really cause these inflammations. And most people are not even aware of their numbers, and you can measure this stuff. I mean, all sorts of ways you can measure what is your omega-3, 6, a little test from a brain span, where you can measure this little pinprick. But whatever it is, if you measure it or not, it's really critical that we can reduce those inflammations, the inflammatory responses from eating, and then mainly from stress. So applying these two major things of inflammation for chronic health and stress in the moment, and then moving it across to the in the long run with mindfulness and actually really being thoughtful about the way we eat, the way we exercise, or the natural sleep that we get. It's not that complicated. The problem is, we know, Ronette, and you and I have discussed this many times, the biggest problem, and it's a very weird quirk of the brain, is this gap between knowing and doing. I mean, I don't doubt there's anything I've said that anybody didn't know. What I certainly have learned in the last 30 years of this and dealing with some of the key opinion leaders around the world for so long, it's really just about that. It's about really laser strategic models, frameworks to get the habits rewired. Mm. Less verbosity and complex explanations and more simple, deep dive training to rewire. And all the rest is just a kind of smoke and mirrors. I mean, it's like, it's not real. I mean, the deep research is really critical. All the siloed research is fundamental, but it's got to be distilled in a way that it helps get us across that knowing to doing gap. And that gap is traversed by the strategic knowledge that we choose and personalize, and then how we take the science of habit and apply it in these small daily steps to rewire, and in a way that the person feels in the long run and in the moment that they're winning, that they're rewiring, secreting dopamine, sharing with those people to get oxytocin bonding, and you change the entire chemistry of the dynamic of and start choosing yourself essentially through your habits and your thoughts.
So that's a great segue to technology, because we've had so many advances in technology and personalized medicine and so many, you know, personal wearables that you can wear to measure your heart rate variability and your breathing. And how's that helping us? How's that moving this forward?
Well, I suppose I'll just focus on two. There's many, but I'll focus on two, Ronit, and sort of to keep it cogent with the description we've had so far of stress in the moment and in the long run as a sort of gateway to optimize mental health. The first is genetics, and we've actually done personalized medicine. Is people think about personalized medicine initially, it's about the genetics, and so it should be. It's worked really well for cancer. It's been pretty revolutionary in terms of cancer therapy and the immune system. But we can also pick up a lot of information about our stress predispositions and inflammatory markers through genetics. So that would be one way to, in the long run, look at the genetics to further titrate the way that, I mean, the pointers in the genetics all the way down to everything we've mentioned, your stress predisposition, your stress sensitivities, how you personalize to, are you sensitive to certain drugs, how you deal with drugs in your brain and in your body. So there's a lot of information in genetics that we can use. But not everybody wants to go there, but it certainly is worth, there's no downside. The main one that has become the kind of currency of the realm at the moment across all the platforms, all digital watches, the bands, is the measurement of heart rate variability. As I mentioned right at the beginning, Ronit, when we're in fight flight, the heartbeat is consistent and rapid because it's to get oxygen to your muscles to get you out of danger. Now, the converse, the vagus, when that is dominating or activated, the beat-to-beat variation is increased. So instead of beating at once per second, you beat in a variable way. And it turns out that variability is health. And if you think about it more broadly, it's because adaptation is a kind of iterative process. It's not a sort of simple cookie cutter thing. You've got to adapt to your environment, you've got to adapt to your personal life, you've got to adapt to your job, you've got to adapt to being at home in COVID. So variability, this cognitive flexibility, this variability is reflected in your heart rate. And the more variable, the healthier. And there is no better marker that I'm aware of. There are over 20,000 publications now of the benefits of boosting heart rate variability. It affects every one of your cognitive capacities. So we know that, for example, stress will reduce your cognition, but increased variability will increase your cognition, increase your memory, increase your well-being. It's beneficial for every single mental health condition. Sounds too good to be true. It's just one of those wacky findings that has turned out to be, like inflammation, it turned out to be an enormously powerful gateway. So measuring that, and now whether it's iWatch or Garmin or any of the bands and watches that are out there, they all after that metric. They are all, if you look at them, if you look carefully, it used to be heart rate that was mainly just used in the sports industry to look at recovery. Mm. It's way more sophisticated than that. So I would say, Ronit, that there's enormous potential benefit to get familiar with heart rate variability and to measure it during the day, even if you just take one single measure in the morning and check what state you're in and check how your sense of stress and anxiety measure is benefiting. And if you train, say, for example, the 6 breaths per minute, within 3 breaths, you can see your heart rate variability going up, so you know you're improving your stress. Within 5 weeks, the evidence is pretty strong that even if you just do 6 breaths per minute breathing for 10 minutes a day, for 5 days a week, for 30 training days, 30-day challenge, so a month basically, you will increase your baseline heart rate variability by 25%. I know of no drug that will do that or anything that will rewire your brain with such ballistic clarity. So there's an example, I'd say, Ronit, where the future of personalization can be measured in terms of what is the best thing to boost your heart rate variability. Was it breath? Was it music? Was it aromatherapy? Is it? There are lots of things that work for different people, but you can track it, see what works for you, and use the objective biometric evidence of heart rate variability and many other things. You can measure your arousal. You can even measure your electrical brain function. So you can use those biometrics, though, to enhance how you or increase your awareness for being in the right place at the right, where you want to be, what brain state you want to live in, and then how to work out what is the most personalized things that work for you to retrain your neural networks and your habits to maximize the most effective 50,000 thoughts a day.
Wow, Evan, that's just, I mean, just so interesting and amazing to hear. And I just love the way you break it down into such an easily digestible, you know, the brain's complicated. When you read about the brain, it's complicated, but you've just given us such an easy roadmap to follow. So thank you. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Ronnie.
Thanks for listening to the Illuminaire podcast with Dr. Ronit Molko. If you like what you heard today, please subscribe, rate, review, and share our show with other listeners. See you next week.